Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On January 27, 1967, astronauts Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee climbed into a new spacecraft perched atop a large Saturn rocket at Kennedy Space Center in Florida for a routine dress rehearsal of their upcoming launch into orbit that was less than a month away. This was at the height of the space race, where the Soviet Union and the United States were competing bitterly to get to the moon first. But once they got into the cockpit, there was a cry heard over the radio, where somebody was shouting that there was a fire there. All three astronauts were experienced pilots and had dreams of walking on the moon one day. But what they didn't know is that once they entered the spacecraft on that winter day, they'd never leave it alive. The Apollo program came very close to failure before it ever got off the ground. But this tragedy, instead of dooming the space program, led to the complete overhaul of the spacecraft, creating a stellar flying machine capable of achieving the program's primary goal of putting a man on the moon. Today's guest is Ryan Walters, author of Apollo 1, The Tragedy That Put Us on the Moon. We discuss how the flawed design of the Apollo 1 spacecraft, miles of uninsulated wiring, an excess of flammable material in a pure oxygen atmosphere, and an unwieldy three-piece hatch doomed it from the start, how NASA awarded the multi-billion dollar contract to build the Apollo 1 craft to a bidder with an inferior plan and management due to political pressure, and how NASA's damaged reputation and growing opposition to spending on space exploration almost led Congress to shut down the space program after the Apollo 1 fire. So all this is about an event that happened over 5 decades ago, but it's very relevant. Elon Musk recently said, in regards to the Starship program to create a reusable rocket that can ferry humans to Mars and back, that a bunch of people will probably die during future Mars missions as his company moves forward with the progression of commercial space travel. So the development of rockets that can carry humans is an inherently dangerous proposition, and we're going to see in this episode that that's always been the case. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Ryan Walters. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and your book takes place in 1967, but there's something contemporary that's relevant to it. So I'm a Elon Musk fan, and he was recently quoted as saying about the Starship program to create a fully reusable rocket that will eventually ferry humans to Mars that a bunch of people will probably die during future Mars missions as his company moves forward with commercial space travel. So criticism ensued for this, but he's not entirely wrong. So for you, in light of the dangerous history of space travel and preparation for space travel, what do you think about his comment, and what do you think about the public reaction to his comment?
Well, his comment was true. I mean, there's never been a truer statement made about space travel. It's always been probably the most dangerous undertaking really in history. I mean, when you're putting men inside a capsule on top of a rocket filled with, you know, high explosives, there's going to be fatalities. There's going to be accidents. There's going to be mistakes. We've seen that in our own space program. So, and I don't really understand the reaction to that, because people need to understand that. It's likely that people will be lost going back to the moon and particularly going to Mars. I mean, I don't think you can find anything more dangerous than that.
Exactly. I mean, the early space program is a modification of Germany's V2 rocket program. So you're basically sitting on top of a giant rocket. What do you really expect to happen?
Right.
Well, let's talk about the state of affairs before Apollo 1. Could you just briefly give an overview of what's already happened with the Mercury and Gemini programs, and what is NASA trying to accomplish with the Apollo 1 mission?
Well, up at that point in 1967, NASA had completed two very successful programs, Mercury, and the goal of Mercury was simple, get a man in space and orbit the Earth. That's all we were trying to do. Very simplistic program by today's standards, but certainly complex at the time. And that program was very successful. The second program was Gemini, and Gemini has been called the bridge between Mercury and Apollo. That's where we perfected a lot of the techniques that we would need to go to the moon, like long duration mission. You got to remember, there was a lot of ignorance at the time about space, about the hazards. There's a lot we didn't know, and people weren't sure that human beings could actually survive 2 full weeks in space. But Gemini was to do that. It was to perfect spacewalking, EVAs, rendezvous and docking. That was a very complex undertaking. So there was a lot of skills that needed to be mastered. And Gemini was very successful, 10 missions in about 20 months. And so it wrapped up in November of 1966. And by that time, we were ready for the first Apollo mission. Apollo, obviously, the program to go to the moon. And Apollo 1 would be the first manned mission to test the brand new Apollo spacecraft. And the launch was set for February of 1967. So just a few months after the end of Gemini, Apollo 1 was set to go into space for a 10 to 11 day mission in Earth orbit, in low Earth orbit, to simply test the spacecraft.
And is this on the Saturn V rocket?
No, the Saturn V was for the moon missions, the missions that were going out to the moon. There was a smaller Saturn rocket called the Saturn 1B. And they would be riding on the 1B just in Earth orbit. But the Saturn V was required to push any of the spacecraft out of Earth orbit and toward the moon. Particularly if you had a lunar lander, you needed the Saturn V. It was our super rocket, our heavy lift rocket. So they were going to be on the smaller Saturn 1B.
Well, let's talk about the astronauts and what they intended to do with this mission. And I'm curious about their backgrounds. It's been the era of the 1960s astronaut has been mythologized, especially by Tom Wolfe in his book, The Right Stuff, where you imagine guys driving Corvettes and drinking whiskey sours and wearing aviator glasses and all that stuff. But what were they like and what did they hope to accomplish with Apollo 1?
Gus Grissom was the commander of Apollo 1, and Gus was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, which is depicted in The Right Stuff. And if you've seen the 1983 movie, and of course, Disney had the new version of The Right Stuff. I think there was one season, but I was, of course, saddened to learn that they had canceled that. There's not going to be any more, at least not for a while. But Gus was one of the original Mercury 7. He had been an Air Force test pilot. That was one of the requirements in the early days. You had to be not only a military pilot qualified on jet aircraft, you had to be a test pilot, a graduate of test pilot school, either the Air Force or the Navy, which is, you know, military pilots are very, very good, but test pilots they're a cut above that because that's the reason they chose test pilots, because they test and fly experimental aircraft that had never been flown before. Somebody's got to do it. And this was the same thing with a spacecraft that nobody's ever climbed in and flown. So the first two groups of astronauts were test pilots. They later dropped that requirement. But Gus was one of the original seven. He was the second American in space in July of 1961. It was a simple suborbital mission. The rockets at the time didn't have the power to get into Earth orbit. He had just an up and down 15-minute flight. Of course, it was noted because the hatch of his Mercury capsule prematurely blew after a splashdown, and the spacecraft sank to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And so he had a little bit of trouble getting around that. It was an investigation. Did he panic? And that's what's depicted in The Right Stuff, that he kind of panicked and maybe hit the button, which is not true. And I dispel that myth in the book. He bounced back, and Gus was instrumental in the Gemini program and developing the Gemini spacecraft, so much so that they nicknamed it the Gusmobile, because he had been so instrumental in helping develop it with the folks at McDonnell Aircraft Company. Ed White was the senior pilot on Apollo 1. He came in with the second group. He was an Air Force test pilot, probably one of the best all-around guys in the astronaut program. You just can't find anybody that had anything bad to say about Ed White. He was just a great all-American guy. He flew on the Gemini 4 mission, the second manned mission of the Gemini program, and he was the first American to walk in space. The anniversary of that was just a few days ago. It was June the 3rd, 1965. So he did the first American EVA, and then he was chosen by Gus to fly on Apollo 1. And, of course, the third member was Roger Chaffee. Roger Chaffee was a rookie. He had never flown in space. He was the third group of astronauts. He wasn't a test pilot, but he had flown recon missions for the Navy and a number of missions over Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So he had he had a lot of experience as well, but certainly not in space. So these were probably three of the best guys that could have been chosen to fly the first Apollo flight.
And so they were going to go into orbit on a less powered version of the Saturn V rocket because they're not going to leave Earth's orbit. What were their mission objectives?
It was a little bit open-ended. They wanted to fly at least 10, 11 days, but they had actually left it up to Gus. They said, you know, if you want to stay an extra day, however many days you want to stay in orbit, because it was what they call a shakedown cruise to test every system of that spacecraft to make sure that spacecraft was where it needed to be in its development. Could it meet all of its capabilities? And so that was the simple objective to do that, a low Earth orbit mission to test the spacecraft. And they had a schedule set up for what they were trying to do. Of course, that all got thrown out with fire. Of course, the other problem was the lunar lander was way behind in production and development. They actually didn't have that ready until the spring of 1969. So, but this was simply an Earth orbit mission to test the spacecraft.
Yeah, it's a very different era. And it's not like the 2000s or 2010s where Boeing and Lockheed Martin are these glacially moving bureaucracies. It really is like the startup culture of SpaceX today in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, Kennedy set the goal of doing that, much to the shock of NASA and much of the rest of the country. And in May of 1961, when he set the goal to go to the moon by the end of the decade, of course, what I detailed in the book is that there were at least one meeting, like several meetings, that Kennedy had with NASA talking about, can we do this and what kind of a timeline are we looking at? So they already had discussed it, the top brass of NASA, with the president. And one of them had even said, well, we think we can do it by 1967, but they wanted a little bit more cushion. But there was still a lot of shock when he actually went before Congress and said this to the entire world. And of course, the money was there. They were willing to spend whatever money they needed to. And at the height of Apollo, NASA consumed about 5% of the federal budget, $5 billion a year, which was a ton of money at the time. Given our current level of spending, or at least what's proposed, it would be like today NASA consuming $300 billion a year in spending. And right now, I think the budget for NASA is about $23 billion, which is just peanuts.
Right. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of resources being plowed into this, which gets to the Apollo 1 mission itself. I'm curious, what happened? And we know there was a fire, but can you describe it in more detail? And why did it happen? Because you would think if there's all these resources being funneled to this, when the space program never received this much money and likely never will receive this much tax money again, was it negligence? Was it just when you're operating at the bleeding edge of technology, these things simply happen? So what happened and why do you think it happened?
Well, you have to also remember, and I teach history at Collin College in North Texas, and I'm probably one of the only history professors, at least that I know of, that actually teaches a full lecture on the space race and the space program. And that's one of the things I tell my students. Don't think about it in terms of we did Mercury, then we had to come up with something else, and okay, we'll do Gemini, and then okay, now we'll do Apollo. Apollo had actually been conceived even during the Eisenhower years. Now, Kennedy jump-started it with the goal and a lot of money funneled into it, but the contracts to build the Apollo spacecraft were actually awarded in the fall of 1961 before we had ever orbited the Earth. So people were already getting ready and developing these systems because it was going to take a number of years to do. And of course, this is primitive by today's standards, but at the time, the Apollo spacecraft was the most sophisticated machine man had ever built. we might laugh at it today. I mean, particularly the guidance computer, but the guidance computer was top of the line. It was designed and built at MIT. But of course, today your average iPhone is 8 million times more powerful than that guidance computer in Apollo. The command module had over 30 miles of wiring, hundreds of connectors. There's a lot of opportunities for things to go wrong. And of course, NASA looked into it because North American got the contract in the fall of 1961, North American Aviation. And of course, in the book, I go into the politics behind that, and there's a lot of political intrigue behind the scenes, which is very interesting. But they won the contract, and they were building the spacecraft. They also had the contract for the second stage of the Saturn V. So North American Aviation had a big chunk of the NASA funds. And of course, things weren't on track. In the mid-60s, General Sam Phillips, who was the head of the Apollo program at the headquarters in Washington, he went out to California, looked around and did a little investigation of his own and didn't like what North American was doing, found a lot of sloppy work, a lot of shoddy workmanship, and basically tried to light a fire on, hey, y'all got to get this right. And they were doing that. Let's understand, there were problems with the spacecraft, but NASA and North American were working to get the problems corrected. And they delivered the spacecraft to Cape Canaveral in August of 1966. They issued a certificate of worthiness saying it was flight worthy, but that had a list of over 100 things that needed to be fixed. And they were working to fix that. And while they were doing that, they were doing various tests. Well, in January of 1967, January the 27th, to be exact, was one of the last major tests, and that was what they call the plugs-out test. The spacecraft is sitting on top of its Saturn 1B booster. Now, the booster is not fueled, thankfully, but the astronauts are, you know, in their suits with their helmets. They're locked inside the spacecraft. 100% oxygen is pumped in. It's the exact conditions that they would be in as if they were in a launch or about to launch into space. So they were doing a launch simulation, doing a simulated launch countdown. And of course, during the test, it drug on hour after hour. There were a number of glitches. They would have to stop the countdown and fix this or fix that. But after about 5 hours of that test, something sparked, wire sparked in that confined spacecraft. And of course, anybody knows anything about that, 100% oxygen under pressure, and the pressure was pretty high in that spacecraft. It was over 16 pounds per square inch. It ignited. And of course, 100% oxygen is highly flammable. You've got a lot of flammable material inside that spacecraft, Velcro and the adhesives for that, the crew couches, the crew suits, all that highly flammable. It went like a blowtorch, literally. The fire swept across the capsule within seconds and killed the crew.
Well, let's get into what happened there. So NASA awards this multi-billion dollar contract to build the Apollo 1 craft. And a point you make in the book is that it's a bidder with an inferior plan and management due to political pressure. So to not give away too much of how you detail this in your book, what are the things that caused this to lead to this disaster?
Well, one of the things I blame it on is politics. And of course, we like to joke. And I think there's some movies, space movies, where they like to use the line, do you know, you realize we're in a spacecraft with millions of moving parts built by the lowest bidder. And that's a joke we all like to tell, and that might be the case with government projects like filling up potholes. But when something's sophisticated like that, they don't give it to the lowest bidder. What they do is they, at least in terms of NASA, they put together a valuation board with experts, engineers, technicians, people that know what they're doing, know what they're talking about. They send out bids they invite people to submit bids, companies, and five aerospace companies did that for the Apollo spacecraft, and they evaluate them. And they give them grades and they rank them. And whoever wins the top grade wins the contract. Well, the contract was originally, was originally given to a company called Martin Marietta. People know it today as Lockheed Martin. And they were the highest score. But NASA brass asked that score be reevaluated and take into account a company's past experience with experimental aircraft. Well, North American Aviation had built the X-15 rocket plane, which NASA and had used to fly to the edge of space. As a matter of fact, a civilian test pilot for NASA was Neil Armstrong. He had flown the X-15 rocket plane to the edge of space before he joined the astronaut corps. And so, of course, when they did that, it bumped North American Aviation up to the top spot. And so they got the lucrative contract. Of course, behind the scenes, one of the reasons they did that is because the chairman of the Senate Space Committee was a senator from Oklahoma named Robert Kerr. Robert Kerr took that position when LBJ, he had been instrumental in the early space program. LBJ had been the chairman of that committee. Of course, he was the vice president. And of course, then Kerr became chairman of that committee. He'd already met with North American Aviation. He had already lined things up. He said, hey, what are you going to do for Oklahoma if I get you this contract? They said, hey, we'll build a plant. We'll hire a bunch of people from your state. And so it seemed to already be in the bag. That's why it was reevaluated. And some people think, well, it should have gone to Martin. If it had gone to Martin, things would have gone differently, obviously. But, you know, that's a little bit of speculation. But we know that North American obviously did get the contract, and they're responsible for the sloppy work and the shoddy workmanship. As a matter of fact, when after the fire, when they did the investigation and took that spacecraft apart, they took one of the panels off the inside wall of that spacecraft, and they found a socket wrench that somebody had left inside the spacecraft. And that's like a surgeon leaving a scalpel inside somebody. I mean, you don't do that kind of stuff. And so that set a lot of people off that it was really shoddy. These wires laying across the ground of the spacecraft, the floor of the spacecraft, they were not in any type of conduit or protected. They were just laying there. So obviously one of them got scuffed, and that's enough to cause a spark and to kill the crew.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, I'd like to dwell on what happens in the aftermath, because if people do think about the space race, they compress these years together into Kennedy's speech challenging Congress to put a man on the moon before the end of the decade. Then there are different missions that happen. The Soviets get the early wins, first man on the moon, first man to orbit the moon, all that. But then America puts it together, has a success, and Neil Armstrong lands on the moon to the celebration of all. But it makes it sound as if there was continuous, steady support of the mission the entire time. And Kennedy's speech was so rousing that it gave enough momentum and inertia to power everyone through the entire 1960s. But of course, that's not the case. So what are people's attitudes right after this? Are they questioning it? Are they thinking, well, this is merely a bump in the road? What's going on?
Yeah, that was one thing that's kind of surprising to people. You think that the whole country was behind NASA the entire time. Hey, this is our great national effort. We got to beat the Soviets. And you're right. The Soviets were ahead of us. First man in space, first man to orbit. You know, in 1957, they put the first object in space with Sputnik. And of course, I talk a little bit about the Soviet program, and I detail in the book that it was really not, they were really not that far ahead. A lot of what they were doing was a lot of gimmicks and things like that. We had a slow, methodical, step-by-step, baby-step approach to do that. They were just trying to use their feats as political propaganda. We had a drawn-out timeline. We're going to do this and this and this, and that's the way we did it. But that doesn't mean everybody thought it was a good idea, particularly when those budget numbers started going up. And there's a lot of political polls that I talk about in the book, where up until the fire, Most people were still for it, but there's a pretty large segment of Americans that did not support it because we were spending so much money. They thought the money should be spent on other programs, LBJ's Great Society, for example, not Vietnam. Of course, that was sucking up more and more money as well. But after the fire, interestingly, about 6 months after the fire, a poll came out in July of 1967 that for the first time showed 54% of Americans believed that the program was not worth the effort because of the sacrifice, the money we were spending, and the fact that we've now lost three people. So that's pretty surprising. It was surprising to me. But of course, NASA didn't look at that and say, well, we better shut it down. Of course, Lyndon Johnson didn't want it shut down because he's dealing with Vietnam and a whole lot of other chaos, you know, the protests in the streets and that kind of thing. And Apollo was like the biggest bright spot he had. So, yeah, he wanted to push it forward. Now, it did shut the program down for 2 years, almost 2 years, while they investigated it, while they took apart the spacecraft and they redesigned it. And that's really the big thing that they were able to. The fire actually exposed the mistakes in that spacecraft, exposed the problems. It sort of ripped it open and said, this is what the problems are. We've got to fix this, like putting 100% oxygen in it and things like that. So the fire actually helped put us on the moon to fulfill Kennedy's goal and meet the deadline. But in my opinion, I think it probably put us on the moon in general, because I think without the fire, not only would we have missed the deadline, I don't think we'd have made the moon at all. With that level of opposition, and as bad as that spacecraft was, there was an accident coming down the road. If it hadn't been for that fire, it would have been something else. And think about it. If we had lost a crew in space, I think that would have been immeasurably worse. That was the opinion of a number of astronauts as well. I said, you know, if we'd lost a crew in space, it probably would have shut that program down for good. At least, I mean, that's speculation, but I think it's a good bet that that's possible.
Yeah, and what exactly about it made the program better? Was it the quality control improved measurably?
Oh, all around. It made spacecraft a lot safer. You got to remember, there was not a lot of safety features. Now, today we think about 100% oxygen under pressure sitting on the ground during a test. I mean, that's enough to scare anybody. And it was at the time. And NASA had some warnings. I talk about that in the book. There were scientists that had wrote papers and things and gave speeches and warned NASA, look, you're taking a chance with this 100% oxygen. But of course, the issue was nobody thought there would ever be an ignition source inside that spacecraft. Of course, that's exactly what happened with Apollo 1 because of the shoddy work that was going on. So, for example, safety features. There was no fire extinguisher in the spacecraft for the crew to put the fire out. Of course, the pressure is high enough, and then you add a fire, you know what the pressure is going to do with that fire. The temperature climbed to 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. You know the pressure is going sky high. So there was no relief valve. They couldn't turn a valve and let that pressure out. And of course, the hatch was a very cumbersome thing, and it's kind of interesting with the hatch because it was Gus Grissom's Mercury mission where the explosive bolts prematurely blew the hatch out. They were concerned, well, if that's the case, we better quit doing that because if a hatch blows out in space, we're going to lose the crew. So they changed that. They quit putting explosive bolts in the hatches. And if they'd had that, they could have hit the button and blew that hatch out and climbed out when the fire started. They didn't have it. Then the hatch they had was terrible. It was a three-layered hatch. The inside hatch that the astronauts had to open actually opened inward, and it had a bunch of latches all the way around it. It took several minutes for them to turn the latches and get it off. There was no way they could have got off. And with the pressure, you can't open it like that. One astronaut that looked into it, he said, you couldn't have pulled it open with a team of elephants, the pressure like that. So they were trapped. It was a death trap for them. So the hatch was redesigned so they could get out in about 3 seconds. They put an escape system on top of the launch pad. You've probably seen the videos, I'm sure everybody has, with the astronauts riding the elevator up to the top and walking across the gantry to the white room. That was the only way down. And so if things got bad, an explosion or a fire, everybody had to try to get in the elevator and get down. So they put a gondola up there that's got cables on it that can sling people away from a launch pad in seconds if something like that happened. Because that fire was so bad, it actually ruptured the spacecraft. That's how much pressure was in that capsule. And it actually, the engineers and technicians that were in the white room during the test, it actually blew them back, knocked them off their feet. That's how bad it was. I mean, fire was spilling outside of the spacecraft. But some brave guys, you know, got some firefighting equipment and got back in there and got the fire put out. Several of them had to be hospitalized with smoke inhalation. So these were all lessons. They were tough lessons that we had to learn. We lost three guys, but we learned a lot, and it made space travel a lot safer. And again, as we talked about in the at the start, it's always going to be dangerous because of what you're dealing with. But, you know, we have accidents. We had Challenger. We had Columbia. Those are lessons that we learn. Hopefully we've learned from, and those things won't happen again.
Well, something I always like to discuss with book authors are historical issues that are large scale and can really apply to any time and place in history. And I think one matter here is a society's risk tolerance, where NASA looked at what happened, they changed their safety standards, but then they moved forward. And perhaps you could discuss why they were able to move forward and not just LBJ wanting a bright spot with Vietnam and other things. But there's always a continuum of risk tolerance where on the one extreme, you could have something like the Soviet space program, where I've heard some of those crafts were death traps and cosmonauts were basically sent to their doom because there was a low premium on human life. I mean, what are you going to do in an authoritarian system? Who are you going to complain to? So that's one extreme where there's really no tolerance or whatever for human life. On the other extreme, a society is way too risk adverse. And space enthusiasts that I've read about have celebrated the 1960s where people had an appetite for adventure and they realized that it was dangerous, but humanity doesn't move forward if we don't accept danger, versus in the 2010s, maybe like kind of like the low point where you have Lockheed Martin or whoever, the United Launch Alliance with the Space Launch System that has cost billions and billions of dollars, but hasn't been able to successfully launch a rocket, even though they're using engines that were on the space shuttle and developed in the 1970s. So, and a lot of these same people love SpaceX for sort of recapturing the spirit of willing to take risks. And if a rocket crashes, you know, that's just part of the learning curve. So, and I don't want to say that everything was perfect too with what NASA did, because yes, the moon landing happened, but in history, it's always easy to look back and think, well, if something succeeded, that means that every step up to there was perfect. And if it failed, then we throw it out saying, well, obviously it was doomed to fail. So there's always the resultism trap to try to avoid. But I guess, what would you say this episode of Apollo 1 would say about risk tolerance? And was it done right? Or what do you make of it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that helped, and again, this is speculation, but the country was going through an upheaval at the time, and particularly as we get into the late 60s, Vietnam, the anti-war protests, there's race riots and all kinds of things going on. And of course, the attention span of most people is not very long. You know, NASA investigated the fire itself. They put together their own committee, which you think about it on the surface, well, they're investigating themselves. They're not going to come up with anything, but that's not true. They actually criticized themselves a lot. The review board did. And I think, you know, with Vietnam going on, people's minds went somewhere else, particularly when we get into 1968, Tet Offensive and all the things that went on, LBJ essentially resigning the office. NASA just put their head down and went to work in conjunction with North American Aviation and really didn't concern themselves with polls, because all of the astronauts were of the opinion, we know we may die when we do this. That they were used to those kind of risks every single day as test pilots. And Gus Grissom, Ed White, Roger Chaffee, the crew of Apollo 1, all of them had said, and it was just before the test, they were all on a national interview with Jules Bergman. All of them said essentially the same thing. Hey, we know we may die. We want the program to go forward. Roger Chaffee even told his dad, I have the quote in the book where he said, look, I want the program to go forward if we don't make it, if something happens. And so you got that kind of people that are taking the biggest risks. They don't want it shut down. And you really can't shut it down. You want to throw all that away that we've already sacrificed when we're this close to the moon. And we were. So the effort that they put into rebuilding that spacecraft, they built a magnificent flying machine that went to the moon 9 times. So the shoddy work, all of that was corrected. The redesigned spacecraft, and I talked to some engineers who actually helped rebuild the spacecraft. They worked almost 2 years to do it and built a really, really great flying machine, the best spacecraft that had been built up at that time. And you're right, a lot of the Soviet stuff was just death traps and that kind of thing, and they didn't really care anything about life. And that's not to say that NASA was uncaring. Now, that's not true at all. That's why they put so much effort into crew safety after that. They put in all these safety features because we don't have that same attitude just to throw lives away. So it made it safer, it made it better, and the fire made it possible for us to fly to the moon. Without the fire, we don't make it.
Is there a particular story from the book that stands out to you?
Well, I guess my favorite chapter is the political chapter, because I'm a political historian. That's generally what I write about. And I got into the politics, but that's part of the story. As I even made the statement that politics killed Gus, Ed, and Roger. Again, as I mentioned earlier with the contract, but there's a lot more to it than what I mentioned. I mentioned Senator Robert Kerr, the chairman of the Space Committee, who was instrumental in helping North American get the contract. And of course, he had replaced LBJ. They were good friends. And when LBJ was vice president under Kennedy, and Kennedy let LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, run the space program, then vice presidents still do today. They're the head of the Space Council. And that's kind of a plum that they get. Kennedy said, hey, who do we need to head NASA? You know, Kennedy didn't want a scientist. He said, I don't want some, you know, nerdy scientist guy. I want somebody that knows how Washington works. I want somebody that understands the system, that can work with Congress, that can get the funding that we need. Lyndon Johnson went to Kerr and said, who do you think I should pick? And Kerr said, I got just the guy. And he chose Jim Webb. Jim Webb was an executive for Kerr's oil company. Robert Kerr had an oil company, the Kerr-McGee Company. And Jim Webb was an executive. But Jim Webb had worked in Washington. He was Assistant Secretary of State and Director of the Budget in the Truman administration. So he had the credentials Kennedy was looking for. So you see that connection between Kerr and Webb. That's why they could reevaluate those scores in favor of North American aviation. And of course, Fred Black and Bobby Baker. People might have heard of the Bobby Baker scandal. Bobby Baker was Lyndon Johnson's right-hand man in the Senate, and had gotten Rang tangled up in a scandal in 1963. All of that is connected to Apollo 1, as I detail in the book. So that chapter is probably my favorite. I call it a web of intrigue, because it is. I mean, I think people, even if people listening to this might say, well, I don't really care that much for the space program, but if you like politics and that kind of thing, I think they'll enjoy that aspect of the book.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Well, thanks for sharing the story. And to round things out, I'd love to get your take on the future and what Apollo 1 can perhaps teach us, because it's an exciting new age. I mean, I consider myself kind of like an amateur space enthusiast. And 2010, 2011, when the U.S. Space Shuttle program was retired, was sort of a low point because The United States now no longer had any way to send humans to low Earth orbit and to send missions up to the International Space Station. We had to rely on Russian rockets. And when there was wrangling back and forth between the US and Russia on how much money Russia would get, somebody from the Russian space program joked that, well, if you don't like what we can do, maybe you can use a trampoline to get up there. That you say, well, you're at our mercy now. And now with companies like SpaceX, and there's all sorts of other private companies coming online, they have a risk tolerance that NASA can't have because it's publicly funded and they have Senate committees they'd have to go to if things happen. Whereas private companies, if there's no human death, they can really test things all the time. And all they have to worry about is if they take a shareholder hit, if they're a publicly traded company. And all sorts of innovations are happening. We're very likely less than a decade away from humans landing on Mars. There's timelines being set up for humans to return to the moon on 2024, perhaps setting up space colonies. The economics of how much it costs to put a human in orbit are going to be completely transformed with reusable rockets. So really interesting things on the horizon. But based on what happened with Apollo 1 and how much it changed things, are there any lessons you think from this that should be remembered as this new chapter in space travel opens up?
Well, unlike you, when the shuttle was retired, we had to rely on the Russians. That was, to me, a low point, but an embarrassment. And the fact that we've got some things in development, but we still haven't put our own craft up there, NASA, even though I think they're going to do another unmanned test pretty soon. But you're exactly right. I like SpaceX, and there are other companies as well. I mean, I think on the news the other day, what Jeff Bezos's company, Blue Origin, it's here in Texas, and he and his brother are actually going to be launched into space July the 20th. I think that's the plan. And I'm really excited about that. I'm hoping we get some space tourism. Now, right now, I think the bids on Blue Origin is like $2.8 million. So that leaves me out.
We'll see how well the book does. Maybe not.
The costs will come down. But I like it. I was really excited about that commercial space travel, because that may be the way to go. And they're going to do it much. It's the cost effect, or it could be much more cost effective, I think, than what the government has done. Of course, the government could just throw a lot of money at it. Of course, we're still throwing money at it, hadn't done anything. But I'm really excited about SpaceX. I'm really excited about Blue Origin, some of those other things. And here's the lessons. You mentioned the lessons. And this is what's interesting. The lessons of Apollo 1, they're already doing. They're already implementing those. I guarantee, and of course, I don't know all their safety features, but I guarantee you most of those lessons they've already put into practice. They're not putting 100% oxygen in that spacecraft anymore. I think the International Space Station is about an 80-20 mix. So they've learned those lessons. You know there are a lot of safety features built in. And a lot of those lessons go back to Apollo 1, because this was NASA's first tragedy. This was our first space tragedy. And we learned a lot of lessons from it. And we learned a lot of lessons from other ones as well. So a lot of those lessons, I guarantee you, they've already got in the back of their mind with that, with Challenger, with Columbia. So that's not to say there's not going to be accidents and mistakes, because we're all human beings, and it is a dangerous undertaking. But so far, they've done very, very well. And here's the other thing. Remember, with Kennedy, we had that push. We got to get to the moon by the end of it. We got to beat the Russians. We got to make it. And so there's that push. And that was one of the things that they noted in the investigation. We're pushing too hard, too fast. And it doesn't look like SpaceX and these other companies are doing that. Even NASA, they're going very slow and methodical. And I think that's a big part of it too. Not just the safety features and some of the other things, but not to get in too big of a hurry. You know, we don't have anything pushing us right now, and there's no sense in getting somebody killed just so we can make some deadline.
Right. And there's a lot more to unpack in this story, too. And for listeners who want to check that out, the book is Apollo 1, The Tragedy That Put Us on the Moon. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate it.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group. And here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Nolan's Rangers. The Nolan's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.